I don't know how many people we have out there, but again, we want to welcome you to this Enterprise Water Optimization Seminar. And today we have the pleasure of having both Jeff Kelly and Alkis Vassakopoulos to give us a presentation on IMPRES, which is sort of a very new and novel way of handling scheduling and supply chain optimization problems. And just very briefly, I think the presentation is going to be given by Jeff Kelly. Jeff did his undergraduate degree at Queen's University and his graduate degree from McMaster University. And he's actually worked also for many years at Honeywell, in particular for Honeywell Process Solutions. And a lot of his work has been directed to the oil industry. And in fact, the other thing about Jeff, he's also been pretty active in terms of publishing papers in the area. Alkis, also to give you a little bit of an idea of his background, so he studied, I guess, economics in Greece, in University of Piraeus, and then did actually a master's degree both at University of Florida and at Carnegie Mellon. Here at Carnegie Mellon, he obtained his PhD under Professor Egon Balas, and actually also has published and has a number of papers, some of which have actually over 300 citations. Alkis actually worked for many years at FICO, where that's a company that lately has taken over the MLP Code Express. So we have sort of now kind of a nice combination between Jeff and Alkis, where combining both planning and scheduling and mixing with the programming. So again, Jeff is going to give us an overview. So Jeff, you're welcome. You want to get started?
Sure. Thank you, Ignacio. So my name is my name is Jeff Kelly, and Alkis is on the phone. He's available to answer questions, and I'm sure he'll join in when he needs to. So the talk today is around using we have a modeling platform called IMPRES for industrial modeling and pre-solving system that's hooked up to many different types of mixed integer linear programming and nonlinear programming solvers, and we're going to show a small jet fuel example, supply chain example, and we're going to generate some scenarios just to show you some of the capabilities of and the technology of what we're doing with IMPRES. So as part of the talk, we're going to give a really, really small introduction about our little venture, industrial algorithms, and then we're going to talk about IMPRES, describe the jet fuel supply chain problem and why it's complex, and then go through some of the reactive scenarios that we've put together regarding the jet fuel supply chain problem. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to provide advanced modeling and solving tools for developing and deploying industrial applications, both in decision making, vis-a-vis planning, scheduling, as well as even things around real time optimization and even control. But also in the areas of what we collectively call data mining. Essentially, what we're doing is more around the issues of data reconciliation and regression.
Just a second, please, Jeff. It looks like if everybody could mute their phone, because we are hearing some conversation going on in the background. So again, if all the participants can please, if they can please mute their phone. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Yeah. So we also do some data reconciliation and regression with the same model that you build. Essentially, you can look both in the past, which is more the data mining things, to do some analytics, and then of course you can look into the future and do things like planning and scheduling and optimization. So again, and then with respect to who are our targets, they're typically operating companies, consulting services, and application service providers in terms of embedding the technology. As I mentioned, our platform is called IMPRES. It can be both. It's more flow sheeting based that I'll talk a little bit more about. And then it's both for offline. Typically, planning and scheduling is offline, and as well as for online environments. And And then we provide some, basically some kickstarts with what we call these industrial modeling frameworks. When you model these complex, especially production chain processes in the process industries, they're actually a little bit more complicated than what you see typically with supply chain. So starting off with sort of like a pre-project is always a good thing to do. And that's what a little bit we're describing here. They're really like a pre-solution, pre-project, we call it like a bit of an advantage, kind of almost like a proof of concept. You can go in and we can build these pre-projects pretty quickly, just to show you the capability of what you can do with it. With Impress, we essentially have it's a very simple architecture. So you can interface it using a flat file. You can interact inside of a programming language, and we've applied this stuff to process. You know, as I mentioned, scheduling, planning, even energy management with respect to things around cogeneration. You know, boilers, steam generators, and turbo generators to produce electricity. Okay, so why are we unique? Essentially what we're doing is everything is flow sheet based, and especially when you do chemical engineering problems, everyone learns about a process flow diagram. You can also call it, of course, a flow sheet. And then you get into things where the flow sheet isn't a network, and we call it a superstructure. A lot of times when you do design problems, you always create a superstructure which has lots of different decisions that you have to make, but you never know. There's always the notion of being able to turn them on or off, or do you build it or not build it, expand it or install it, kind of decisions. And in fact, we have those kinds of decisions also in scheduling, because you may have a piece of equipment that can have many different types of operations attached. And the job of scheduling is to pick which operation, and it also looks like a superstructure. So we've devised our own superstructure modeling technology, similar to the state test network. People are familiar with batch scheduling optimization and the resource test network. We're a little bit more advanced or comprehensive, but what we do is we manage a little bit more of the limited connectivity that you'd find with a state test network or a resource test network, especially around managing parallel equipment. And we also handle batch and continuous. And so a lot of times state test network has really only been used mostly, although it can be used for continuous processes. You mostly see it being used for batch processes. But with this unit operation port state superstructure, you can have any kind of mix of batch and continuous types of processes and how they interact. What we do with Impress is if you use a modeling language like Moselle or GAMS or Ample, you have to set up all of the sets and lists and parameters and variables and constraints, and essentially all of the derivatives and expressions in terms of the nonlinear expressions, especially with GAMS, for example, and then computing all of the analytical derivatives is all done for you. We do the same thing, except what we do, we also have a predefined set of sets or lists and parameters that are specific to the unit operation port state superstructure framework. And so in terms of when you set up a model, basically set it up in terms of the semantics of the problem. You have a unit, it has operations, and then you'll put flows or holdups or set up times with it. And so managing all of the sets and parameters that you have to do with a GAMS, and then, of course, write all the variables and constraints, which we refer to as coding, we do that for you. And then, of course, mapping the model to the matrix, and where the matrices they can then be solved by MILP and NLP, we also hand those over to multiple different types of open source or commercial solvers. So as we mentioned, Impress is more it's somewhat object-based. We call it shape and sheet-based in the sense that you'll draw on different types of shapes, which I'll show in a second. And then the sheet essentially refers to something like a spreadsheet where you will fill in all of the different types of property data with it. And as mentioned, you can consider GAMS and AMPL AMPL and Moselle and OPL as algebraic modeling languages, and essentially they're set-based, which means that you have to define sets to reference all of the parameter and variable and constraint indices. Then you'll have other types of modeling language, like the Aspen Custom Modeler, ASEN, GPROMS, AP Monitor, and some other ones. And these are more structure-based in the sense of you'll define unit operations, and then you'll be able to connect them up using transfer connection equations. And then platforms like MATLAB, Mathematica, these are more scalar-based, but really they're more matrix and vector-based. They're a little bit harder to use for when you model more complex things. So with Impress, we're essentially a combination of all three, and but it's a little bit more visual in terms of being able to semantically see the objects, or what we call the shapes. The way that you configure it, we have two ways that you can put in the model. You can put it in using a flat file, what we call the industrial modeling language, and then you can actually, if you want to, you can build the entire model using our APIs, which you can code in C or C++ or Python, and you can populate models like that. And both you can get populate the model as well as you can get back the solution inside of a programming language as well. So in terms of, I mentioned the difference between coding, which is typically you're going to take a GAMS and write all of your sets and parameters and variables and constraints. What we're trying to do is to reduce the barrier to entry in terms of being able to, for someone to get up quickly, build a model, be able to solve it, and then capture the benefits of being able to do that, basically the real value behind using optimization. And so what we do is we have as mentioned, this flow sheeting concept where it's all based on unit operations, which are very well known in chemical engineering. They could be batch processes or continuous processes or hold up things such as tanks, or we call them pools. And then we use a concept from process simulation where back in the 70s they talked about explicitly modeling inputs and outputs, and they call them ports, and we added the state to represent different types of materials that or resources that you can attach to that. And so then you can create these unit operations and all of the different port states attached. And then, of course, to connect them up, you'll connect them up in terms of unit operation port state to downstream other unit operation port states. Those then define essentially all of the different types of keys or references or sets. And then from there, you can apply what we call quantity logic and quality phenomenon parameters. These are things such as lot sizing, lower and upper bounds for tanks. They are charge sizes, batch sizes, input and output yields or recipes, flow bounds, run lengths, sequence-dependent setup times, certification delays on tanks. If you're shipping gasoline out of a tank, there's a certain amount of time that it takes to mix it as well as certify it with a lab. So you can model all of those different types of delays inside of Impress. And so quantity, the quantity phenomenon details flows and holdups and yields. The logic phenomenon deals with setups, startups, switchovers, shutdowns, and switchovers to others, which of course are when you do sequence-dependent. And then we have a lot of complexity around managing different types of qualities, and we have four types of qualities, which are densities, compositions, properties, as well as conditions like temperature and pressure. This slide shows we use the We use the open source modeling system, drawing package called Gia, where you can draw these different shapes. So you can draw parameters and pools, as I mentioned, batch processes, continuous processes that everybody knows about. Dimensional processes, we don't do much, but this is around pulp and paper, where you go from rolls to that different sheets. You also see that in casting plants, metals plants, where you take liquid metal and then you'll cast it into ingots or logs or what have you. So there could always be a dimensional side to the problem. We have objects to do movable inventories, which we call parcels. You'll see that with the jet fuel example with the trains. We also implement pipelines, and we essentially use the first-in, first-out FIFO model from another student of Ignacio's, Jose Pinto's. We implement his stuff. And we also have the concept of a pile line, which manages LIFO. So you'll see that in mining when you blast the side of a mountain off and you'll take the big trucks to pile it. You'll pile it in a LIFO fashion. And so being able to manage that kind of inventory can also be an important thing to do. This slide is just, again, talks about our system architecture, and we have six components, essentially DLLs or shared objects, and where you can basically call these things from any kind of programming language, and you can run Impress. And as I mentioned, the reason why we do this is because we can make it both offline and online, and so being able to run this every minute or every 5 minutes or something, having a in quotes, a simple architecture is very useful. Okay, so now we hit the jet fuel supply chain industrial modeling framework example, and I think at first glance it looks pretty complex. So what we have here is we essentially have a really simple crude unit. The first part of this is a refinery. And, of course, a crude unit can accept multiple crude oils as a mixture. And sometimes most of the time there's tanks. But it can be, crude oils are typically delivered via pipeline or ship. But now you'll also find, because of this oil, the shale gas, or oil shale, and as well as the tar sands in Canada, sometimes the crude oil can come in on rail cars. So there's about three different ways you can bring a crude oil in. In this example, we're using three crude oils, and they come in to the start of this crude unit, and we model the crude unit as a subtype of a fractionator. A fractionator basically will take the assays of each of the crudes, and it will cut them up. You'll cut them up using some assay management system into pseudo components or micro cuts, as we call them, and then each compound or each outlet port here represents a certain macro cut of how the crude oil will split, as well as mix together or pool together, because in this case we have three crude oils. And so each one of these ports here, outlet ports, represents the amount of, in this case, methane, ethane, propane and butane, naphtha, a couple swing cuts, jet fuel, which is the main product, main co-product that we're looking for, as well as some distillate and some atmospheric resid, which goes to a vacuum tower. This really doesn't have much to do with the jet fuel supply chain problem, but we just show that as being something interesting to do with respect to having, in this case, the ability to cascade multiple fractionators in series. For example, with some other tools, it's not really possible to do that. Something like a PIMS or an RPMS can have difficulty with this kind of flow sheet arrangement. So then we have, because we're only interested in jet fuel, these methane and ethane, basically they just leave. Obviously they'll go to some other downstream processing unit, but it's not germane to the focus that we have here with the jet fuel problem. So with the jet fuel, there's a couple swing cuts, and these are blended together explicitly in a blender. And So in this case, we have two inlet ports. This is an example of a convergent flow path process. Two inlet ports make one outlet port. And then from here, from these jet fuel blenders, we're making jet A and jet B. In this case, we're assuming they differ by sulfur, some sulfur property, mass-based sulfur property, but of course they can differ on some other properties. But just to keep it simple, we just distinguish them based on sulfur. Then you'll have some jet fuel tanks at the refinery. And in this case, we have essentially there's only two tanks. We hypothetically split a portion of this tank, jet A, into two, a jet A and jet B, because what we're doing is we're going to generate a scenario where we're going to remove some capacity of this tank. Essentially, we're saying that this tank is too big. There's another tank in the refinery that's smaller, and the refinery manager wants to swap this bigger tank to be used in some other service for a smaller tank. And then, of course, one of the scenarios is to see, is that feasible? Then we have two trains, and in fact, with the volume that we're moving, there's two tracks as well. One of the trains, these are what are called unit trains. Unit trains are dedicated to a particular fuel. So there's about 100 different, they can have 100 different rail cars on one of these unit trains. So the first train, we've decided that it could be modeled, or it operates where if it fills, it can only fill up jet A. It cannot fill up jet B at the same time. But when it comes back again, it can fill up jet B, but only one or the other. So it's mutually exclusive. And then the train 2 can be partially filled. Well, both trains can be partially filled in terms of the cargo. But train 2 can have a certain amount of cargo filled with jet A and jet B simultaneously. So let's say 50 cars can be jet A and then 50 cars can be jet B. Then there's a round trip time, or travel or transit time, for the trains. And essentially what that models is the fact that we have a, what we've done is we've arbitrarily said that there's a 4-day round trip time. There's 1 day to load the trains, 1 day to travel to the airport, a second day to offload or draw out the material at the airport, and then one more day to bring it back to the refinery. So that's how we're moving inventory. And if you notice, we use an upside down triangle to represent what we call parcel units. And parcel units essentially are no different than modeling a batch unit in the state test network, for example, except that this batch unit could actually have two different, especially this one. This one has two batch sizes. One to represent the flow of jet A or the holdup of jet A, and the other one for the holdup of jet B. We also allow partial loading, which means that if you bring in 49,000 barrels of jet A, when you load it, when you unload it, you're going to draw out exactly the same amount that came in terms of the managing the flow of jet A that comes out. To do that, over the span of this round trip time, travel time, we have to do a material balance to make sure that how much comes in is exactly equal to how much comes out. It's like doing an overall material balance around a batch process. It's easier when it's the batch process is fixed time. You basically know the cycle time. So we're doing that. Then, of course, at the airport, there's a couple tanks. We're doing the same thing here with playing a game with the capacity, but in the scenarios that we're generating, we're not doing anything with it. And so there's tanks of jet A. There's one tank of jet A, one tank of jet B. And then there's some demand over a 30-day horizon for jet A and jet B. So I know it's a little complicated, but this is essentially the jet fuel supply chain scenario that we've put together as an example to show some of the complexity around modeling these types of processes. And I'm going to go through a little bit more of the detail. So on the refinery side, just to summarize, we have three crude oils, and they can have varying composition. We have a pipe still or a crude distillation unit. We model as a fractionator. There's 8 compounds or micro cuts or essentially streams that can come off. The nominal charge size is 20,000 meter cube per day, medium-sized type of refinery, plus or minus 5%. We just put that in to show that we can do some lot sizing, varying the capacity through the fractionator. We have 2 swing cuts, and then there are 2 blenders, as I mentioned. There's a VDU, but it really doesn't play much with the jet fuel because the VDU does not produce any jet fuel. We have 2 jet fuel products, jet fuels A and B, and I hypothetically said that jet A has a sulfur spec weight percent of 0.125 and jet B has a sulfur weight percent of 0.25. And we need to be able to create a blend of those swing cuts and the virgin jet fuel that comes off that respect those upper sulfur bounds. And we have, as I mentioned, we have 2 dedicated jet fuel tanks of 16,000 meter cube each. However, we're going to drop the jet B tank from 16,000 to 12,000 in terms of a scenario to hypothetically consider that we're going to see if we can get by with only having a 12,000 meter cube tank of jet B instead of the 16,000. The railroad, as I mentioned, these unit trains, they have 100, typically about 100 tankers. Each one can hold about 120 meter cube. So the entire train can hold about 72,000 barrels of jet fuel, in this case of product. Train 1 can haul either jet A or jet B, and train 2 can haul both at the same time. Not exactly equal amounts, they can vary a little bit, but the way that we've set up the constraints, they're pretty close to being equal amounts. As mentioned, we allow partial loading, but the loading has to be greater than 90%, or basically it may not make sense through economies of scale to actually ship through one of those trains. And also we have to respect the fact that at the refinery and at the airport, even though there's 2 tracks, the trains can move together. At the refinery, you can only load one train or the other train, and at the airport, you can only unload. And when we look at the Gantt chart, you'll see that those contentions are respected. At the airport, as I mentioned, we have 2 dedicated tanks, both of holding 14,000 meter cubes each. And the demand typically for each day over the 30-day horizon we're going to look at is 3,000 meter cube plus or minus 5%, and then 2.5 meter cube, 1,000 meter cube plus or minus 5%. We just put a little bit of variability in there because, in fact, there always is some level of variability, some latitude that a refinery, or in this case it's not the refinery, but there's always going to be a little bit of demand variation or supply variation. So in terms of the decision making, essentially we have to pick the fractions of the 3 different crude oils. So those are these are basically quality decisions. We need to determine the recipes for each of the jet fuel A and jet fuel B blenders. We need to, within the bounds, select a charge size or throughput for the CDU. We need to determine the swing cut flows. Those are decision variables in terms of how much draw off of the CDU you can have. You typically do that by people who are oil refining by pump arounds and manipulating the temperature profile. But we're just going to assume that we can determine those, and then we can send those down as a controlled target down to some control system, as well as the cargo sizing and schedule of the trains in terms of when they start loading and offloading. And then hypothetically, in this case, we're just maximizing profit or maximizing the demand within those fixed or narrow demand, jet fuel demand bounds. We're not considering cost here, but of course we could. This is just basically a hypothetical objective function just to optimize something. A lot of times with scheduling, there's in some cases not a lot of opportunity to do optimization because the supply and demand profiles are essentially fixed. But in this case, we're doing something. Why is the problem complex? As everybody knows, when you consider the quantity, what we call the quantity and logic phenomenological variables and constraints, which, as I mentioned, were flows and setups and in this case, sulfur property, definitely it's an MINLP problem. Now, there's some good MINLP solvers, especially the one from Professor Grossman, DICOP, but the size of them, with a lot of time periods and things, they can, you know, they can have some scaling issues. And so what we do is we don't really get into solving MINLP's problems. We'll break it up into what we call a phenomenological decomposition heuristic, essentially, and we'll solve what we call a quantity and logic problem first, which is we call logistics, and then we'll solve a quantity and quality problem second. Essentially, we're doing MILP down to NLP, and then you can iterate within those. That's how we're managing complexity. And at best, you can only do find optimized globally feasible solutions. We are making no claims at all that this will ever find a globally optimal solution. But it's better to do something pragmatic so you can at least get some sort of solution versus, you know, this MILP solver taking a very long time to solve. Or if it does come back, it can come back as infeasible, and then it's a very difficult task to figure out why. So in this case, in terms of the complexity, we're doing what's typically called closed shop lot sizing. So we're doing inventory management of both the supply side and demand side around the train. We're managing the round trip time of the trains, which, as I mentioned, they look like batch processes. We're handling the pooling problem with respect to sulfur. That famous Haverly pooling problem is part of this. And then, of course, all of the parameters can have uncertainty with them. And we just talked a little bit about that by having the plus or minus 5% types of uncertainties with it. But in industrial problems, everything is uncertain. Now, we can't really manage that too well, so you basically create scenarios or cases to help with understanding what if you have too much uncertainty over here versus there. And we'll talk a little bit about that. In terms of how we're solving, we learned recently that Joseph Calarate has a term. He calls this kind of modeling, when you do decomposition, polylithic versus monolithic. An MINLP solution would be monolithic. So our phenomenological decomposition is more around what is Dr. Calarate calls polylithic. And as I mentioned, we're solving an MILP, and then we pass it down to an NLP, and then you can iterate. And essentially what we're doing in terms of this primal heuristic algorithm is we're going to be determining yields, basically the process yields from those continuous processes like those fractionators. We're going to be determining those yields using an NLP, and then we're going to send those yields down to the logistics MILP. And hello, I'm hearing some buzzing. Is that a problem?
No, go ahead, Jeff.
Okay, sorry. I didn't know if there was some audio technical difficulties there. So we fix the yields. We'll solve an MILP. And then what we'll do, you can iterate back, whereby the MILP will find setup and startups logic variables. And then you can pass those back into the NLP by fixing them. And now we're back to solving a quantity and quality problem with fixed logic. And then you can basically from there, you can create, it'll generate other yields. And then you can iterate and do essentially like what's called a truncated Bender's decomposition. And how we manage that, at least in a primitive fashion, are through these time-varying, what we call conjunction values, which are going to be the yields from the NLP and then the setup and startup variables from the MILP. And naturally, this is in a lot of cases, believe it or not, a lot of applications solve it this way. And again, we're really just going for global feasible solutions. The types of solvers we can connect to, just in terms of how you solve the MILP, it could be any of the solvers that everyone knows about. In this case, we're going to be using SCIP from the Technical University of Berlin. And for the NLP, you know, everyone's heard of ConOpt and IPOpt and Nitro. A less well-known one is Express SLP, but I've used that one quite extensively in the past before, and it's very good. But we also have our own SLP QP algorithm that works pretty well for these types of planning and scheduling types of problems, which, and I won't go into too much detail, but because we're dealing with a lot of bilinear things of x times y instead of x squared or x times x, our Hessian, implied Hessian, is a lot of cases indefinite or lots of off-diagonal elements, and that encourages by itself vertex solutions. That's one of the reasons why SLPs and PIMs and RPMS and GRT, MPS, for planning systems, that's why SLP works out essentially pretty well. So in this case, let me just see what we're doing here. Lost my train of thought. So in terms of how do we, one second here. I think I passed it. Let me go back. Yeah, so just to reiterate, how we solve this jet fuel problem is we solved an NLP first, essentially one time period, that determined the compositions that we're going to use. Typically, that's typically what you'll see as a feedstock selection, where they'll use PIMS and RPMS to do that in refining. Then we fix those yields that come off the fractionator. We fix the compositions. And then we solve an MILP problem. And the scenarios that we're going to show are really just the scenarios with respect to the MILP problem. So to solve this problem, we did solve two optimizations, one NLP with a one-time period model, and then a 30-day, 30-time period MILP problem. And these are the types of scenarios that we're going to show. So in terms of how do we manage all of the different types of data with respect to the quantity logic and quality things, we essentially break them down into each parameter has a lower, upper hard bound and then a target soft bound. And you put in all of that data in continuous time. We're only doing discrete time in this case, but you put the data in continuous time, and then we have a digitization engine that will digitize and basically take that continuous time data and chop it into discrete time or digitized data. And that's the data that will then populate all of the time-varying parameters in terms of lower, upper, and target bounds. And that's what we pass over to the modeling when it determines all the different types of constraints. We also manage what's called the wet plant problem in terms of knowing what's happened just in the past in terms of opening inventories. And essentially, if a train had already started and it had 2 days left, we also manage the run length or the round trip time, the partial round trip time, right in the immediate past or the present. As I mentioned, in terms of our interface, we have a certain way to interface all of this diverse type of data. Essentially, everything is keyed through this unit operation port state superstructure. And then we have lower, upper, target, this quantity logic quality phenomenon, and then you can have begin and end times. And this is that continuous time stuff that I mentioned. Not only do we manage a superstructure, but of course, in the end, in fact, it generates a hyperstructure, because when you add time periods to things, you you take that superstructure, add time, it becomes a hyperstructure, or you can model the different sites separately, and that also creates a more of a spatial hyperstructure to the problem. We didn't do that, but I just thought I would mention the fact that it, in the end, when we actually at solve time, it's really solving a hyperstructure because it's more than just a superstructure because we've added time periods to it, and then when you start looking at multiple sites, it can get pretty big, and essentially it's this fancier term called a hyperstructure. Okay, in terms of the scenarios, we essentially looked at three types of hypothetical scenarios: demand variability at the airport, with respect to the fact that you can hypothetically say that at the airport there was more of a demand for Jet A and Jet B during the weekends, maybe because there's more flights that occur on the weekends. Then, of course, we have tank availability. This was the fact that the refiner manager would like to swap a larger tank in the jet fuel area with a smaller tank from somewhere else, which typically happens. And so the ability to maintain, keep your existing schedule, keep it globally feasible are things that the refinery manager likes to ask. And then we add a little bit of train reliability in terms of trains are getting old. So at a certain point during the horizon, we said that we would have that these trains could be sent to preventative maintenance. So there's essentially just a fixed downtime with them. Oops. This is, you can't really see it too well, but essentially what you do is you create a base case, what we call an IML file. And then for each delta case, for each scenario, you can overload it. So for one scenario would be a delta case, you would read in the base case, then you would overload the data with a delta case, and then that would set up a completely new problem. This is just slide explains a little bit more how we interface those conjunction variables with respect to what we're saying were those managing back and forth yield data. So we generated yield data from the NLP, and then you can read that in into Impress again. When it solves the MILP, it will use this yield data, and of course the yield data can also be time varying. In this case it wasn't because we just solved a one time period nonlinear problem. Okay, so as I mentioned, we have 31 day time periods. We have over 2,000 continuous variables, 3,000 constraints, 10,000 non-zeros, and about 750 binaries. The base case objective function is $169.2 using our hypothetical $1 per 1,000 meter cube pricing. And we're using skip, and it's pronounced skip, and it takes 27 seconds on a Windows 7 Intel Core i7 laptop. So not bad. So this is the Gantt chart that shows the results. All of the black are basically the setups of each of these different pieces of equipment, tanks and the trains. Right here you see, this is, if you were to look at it, this is actually spans 4 days. And you can see that when it's for train one, it's either Jet A, Jet B, two runs of Jet A, one run of Jet B, and then another of Jet A. They don't occur simultaneously. There's no overlap because there's a single use or unit resource constraint implied. We also, for the tanks, you can see a trend line. That's essentially the inventory profile. As I mentioned here, it's superimposed. So that's essentially the base case scenario. Then we apply two demand variability scenarios. One at where we're saying that during the weekend, you can see here, with Impress, you can have calculations. So we created a hypothetical calc called a weekend, and we increased it from 1 to 1.1, which we're going to multiply that weekend parameter or calc by the lower and upper demand, you'll see it jet lower weekend, jet upper. So for each of the weekends, and essentially we assumed that the start of schedule was on a weekend. That's why we see from 0 to 2 for the two-day weekend. So for the weekends, we hypothetically increase the demand. And then the question is, when we do that, is there enough available capacity and capability within the existing jet fuel problem or model or plant to find a feasible schedule with that? So the answer is yes. Skip found that solution in 38 seconds. I got a higher profit because it was able, because there is no more demand on the weekend, of 170.3. And this was for a 10% weekend demand increase. And if I go to the next slide, this one's for a 20%. And if I toggle a little bit back, you can see there is a little bit of variability with the demand profiles. But it's still, it looks like it's almost kept the train schedule the same, a little bit of variation with respect to the to train two. But these are the types of, I'm not going to say games, but these are the types of what-ifs you can do with Impress by basically changing some of the input data, the delta case, from a base case, and you can see whether or not, in this case, we're really going for global feasibility. That's really our goal. Going for more optimality, you know, we're not expecting it, but we're just trying to make sure that everything is feasible. Then, of course, we did the tank availability scenario, where we, if you noticed here, right here, there was that hypothetical Jet AB tank. What we did was we zeroed out. It had a base case upper bound of 4, so total. Between the two, there's 16, but what we did is we zeroed it out, so now we only have a capacity available for Jet B of 12. So our question is, if we can find for that hypothetical 30-day time horizon, if we can find a feasible solution, then you can go back to the refiner manager and say, listen, yeah, I think we could, given this scenario, I'm not saying it's general, given this scenario, you could, in fact, remove that tank. And so these are some of the questions you can ask. And it was, in fact, feasible. Skip found it in 18 seconds. And the objective function is pretty close to the same. The final scenario had to do with essentially shutting the train down sometime during the horizon. And what we're doing here is we're saying that on time period or day 14 to 15, we're going to set down, or basically we're going to, the reason why it's minus one is because when we discretize any overlapping time periods, we add them all together. So we had a one to start off with for zero to one to make it binary. We subtract one, we'll make it zero. So essentially the lower and upper bound for train one for the 14th time period, or actually I think it's more the 15th time period, will be zero. And we did the same thing. That's just to simulate the fact that there has to be some preventative maintenance that has to happen on it. And then train two, we do the same thing, but we do it at the very end of the month. And when we run that, we can also, in skip, finds it in 15 seconds. It also finds a feasible solution. And you can see that it's right here, between here and here. There's a downtime for train one. There's nothing happening. We respected that. And then for the train two, that there's a downtime at the 29th or 30th time period, it's also respected that. But it's also been able to use the capacity of the tanks, what have you, to find a feasible scenario. This slide just really, you know, talks about one of the big holy grails is how do you compare multiple solutions. We don't really do a lot of that. Some of the work is ad hoc. So being able to compare multiple Gantt charts simultaneously, where you show multiple scenarios together, we don't do a lot of that. The other thing you can do is use some data mining. You can do some clustering. You can use some PLS, PCA to basically compress the multiple scenarios and pick apart the differences. Again, that's more of an ad hoc data mining exercise. And that's essentially it. We would especially like to thank Professor Grossman for inviting us to give this talk. Hopefully it was useful. Hopefully you learned something. Thanks. And if you have any questions, that would be great.
Okay, Jeff, thank you very much for that presentation. And let's see, do we have any questions out there from the audience to Jeff? We always have a shy audience. Doesn't look like. Let me start out by asking the following, because that part to me was not real clear. So when you do the MILP, are you using discrete time or continuous time?
Discrete time,
okay. Then how finely do you discretize?
In this case, we use one-day time periods.
Right.
And we looked over a 30-day time horizon.
So it's really then 30 time periods, right?
That is correct. There was only 30 time periods in this case.
Well, one of the questions then, how do you handle changeovers? Because that's usually kind of a tricky, I guess in this problem, there were no changeovers. Is this correct?
Yeah, in this case, there were no sequence dependent. You can have, if you have a segregated pipeline downstream and you're actually managing the pipeline, you know, you would have to, you have some sequence dependent issues with the fact that, if you put in diesel, you cannot put jet fuel right after. You can have to be, you know, flush it with the gasoline. So there you would see some sequence-dependent issues. Again, with our technology, it would still be discrete time.
Okay, good. Thank you. Any questions here in the audience? It looks like everybody's still early. So one more other question. For the NLP, you have sort of blending equations which involve bilinear terms, and I guess these are in principle non-convex. Can you comment on likelihood of getting trapped in local solutions, or do you have any special strategies to try to maximize the probability of ending up with global or near global solutions?
Yeah, these problems, the NLP problems, they're always, we only ever find at local solutions, they're always non-convex because, as you mentioned, whenever you have a bilinear term plus or minus another bilinear term, which is the classic pooling problem, non-convexities always occur. So we don't, at the moment, we do not do any, you can do multiple restarts by randomizing the initial values. You can do that. That's essentially like doing another type of scenario. You can do things like that. We don't do any things around, you know, reformulation, relaxation, or any sort of spatial branch and bound search. What we do, though, one thing that's unique and impressive, to do all of the derivatives, we are using this the method called the complex step. So we're getting analytical quality derivatives numerically. So we're getting very good derivative information. And the problem, of course, is when you get derivatives that can go to zero, where at that point it becomes degenerate. You don't know if you need to increase a flow or decrease a flow. So around there, we have some primal heuristics that will help manage that as we do the derivatives, but specifically nothing around global optimization. Correct. The other thing that you see is that because we are solving an MILP and then an NLP, what we do is when we solve the MILP, we'll save multiple of those solutions that come out. Typically, you can even find 100 different solutions that can come out, and we save those into a solution pool. So you can always then run the NLP off of that to get a different solution, but of course the NLP that you run is still only local,
right,
correct?
Right. I understand. And let's see, so again, any question out there or here in the audience?
This is Kevin Furman. I've got a question. Hi, Kevin. Hey, Jeff. Have you tested it on like extremely large models for chemical plants or refineries or anything like that? And
yeah,
do you have a feeling on what kind of limits you hit in terms of getting solutions for very large, like plants or very detailed models and that sort of thing?
Yeah, these are all yes, we have. Obviously, when you have lots of binary variables and lots of when you have lots of intertemporal transfer of logic, like lots of uptimes that need to be managed. as well as the binary variables, then of course, you know, you're at the mercy of how well a Gorobi or a Cplex or Express can solve the problem. And then with respect to solving very large and complicated, mostly planning and scheduling type nonlinear problems with lots of linear, lots of bilinear, lots of trilinear, a little bit of, you know, ad hoc, nonlinear, discontinuous, we find that the right approach to solve that is actually SLP using an IP opticon off the Nitro. They really cannot scale to solve those types of nonlinear problems. Again, especially when you have lots of time periods and the problem becomes extremely degenerate, the value at each major iteration of a pre-solve, the linear pre-solve, is enormous. And so solving these types of large-scale nonlinear problems that we see in planning and scheduling, the only way to go really is SLP.
Right. And do you have a feeling on, and I know that you may or may not be able to answer this, but do you have a feeling on how your performance would compare with any of your competitors like AspenTech or Honeywell or Invensys and that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, even about a month ago, I saw the presentation from Demetrius Varvarosis, another former, I don't think I pronounced his last name correctly.
It's Varvarosis.
Yes, thank you. Another former student of yours. And we talked a little bit. We you know, I think we're both on the same page in terms of for planning and scheduling problems, SLP is really the only way to go. And I know that XNLP does solve SLP. So, yeah, I think, you know, I think we're pretty comparable with at least technology selection for the nonlinear types of large-scale planning and scheduling problems. Well, I'm not sure if I answered your question, but
I think that kind of covers what I was going to ask. Okay, thank you.
Okay, all right. Well, maybe on that note, again, let me thank very much Jeff with an applause for a very nice presentation. Okay, thanks everybody for participating. Thanks again, Jeff and Alkis. Okay, see you then. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Okay, bye.
Bye.